My topic tonight is the American perspective and reaction to the events of the Six-Day War. There is no small irony in the fact that the only person in the room who spent the Six-Day War in Australia and two decades thereafter has been tasked with speaking about the American scene tonight. But you'll forgive me because the expression of what was felt here was felt in Australia and around much of the Jewish world. And although there will be differences between the various locations, much of how we as Jews reacted to those days was common across the diaspora. Everything in Jewish life, I have found, is for a reason. This week's Haftarah contains the words of Zechariah. They're words that we read twice a year, both in association with Baha'alotcha, the Torah portion of this week, as well as at Hanukkah. And you know what Zechariah has to say. Lo v'chayil v'lo v'choach, ki im baruchi amar Hashem Tzvaot. Not by might and not by power, but by my spirit, says the God of hosts. Lo v'chayil, not with armed forces. Lo b'koach, not with strength, with my spirit. So I have a problem with Zechariah. Jewish history has a problem with Zechariah. And the Six-Day War was a remarkable turning point for the Jewish people around the world, for one central reason. It returned us to power. Jewish power became a reality, a tangible reality, for the first time in 2,000 years. Oh, you might say, but 1967 wasn't 1948. 1948, surely 1948, that was the moment when Jews really attained power. To which I think we have to respond as follows. There is a difference between sovereignty and the power that is associated with sovereignty and the power that really makes a people sense that they are powerful. We had sovereignty in 1948. We were not powerful. Had we been powerful in those two decades, from 1948 to 1967, they would not have been busy digging tens of thousands of graves in public parks around the state of Israel in the lead up to the Six-Day War. They would not have shuddered when Levi Eshkol came on the radio trying to reassure the nation that all would be well only to succeed in making people even more nervous. And we, the people of the diaspora, Yitz Greenberg recounts going to shul in that week leading up to the war, when people openly discussed the expectation that Israel would be no more. Two decades after the Shoah, at a time when we could barely even speak of the Shoah, we prepared for another one. That was the mentality. Zachariah had been right for 2,000 years. There was no might. There was no power. We were the weakling of history, pushed around, the victim of the centuries, always persecuted. It had happened in the most nightmarish way imaginable in the first half of the 20th century. We assumed that history was about to repeat itself, only more tragically. So what did the Six-Day War really mean? It meant euphoria. It meant euphoria of a quasi-religious type. It meant the inversion of 2,000 years of Jewish history. It meant the inversion of all those centuries where our spirit was all we had, and bowing to the authorities was what we had to do, because there was no other way. There was, Yossi Klein Halevi writes, an emotional trajectory that came out of the Six-Day War that united Jewish people in a way I don't think we've ever seen since the revelation at Mount Sinai 3,500 years ago. For a shining period, we were united as at Sinai, beholding something that we had never expected would come to be. Continues Yossi Klein Halevi, the euphoria was a combination of realizing we had just witnessed the greatest military victory in Jewish history, as well as the restoration of those parts of the land of our past that had been denied to us. Before the Six-Day War, Israel didn't possess a single significant Jewish holy site. In some way, the state had been emptied of its religious content, of its soul. And after the war, we experienced the return to the Kotel, to the tombs of the matriarchs and the patriarchs in Hebron, and to Rachel's tomb near Bethlehem, as a restoration of everything that had been taken from us. The parents' generation had no access to their ancestral graves, either because they were forced to leave them behind, in the case of the Jews of the Arab world, or because they didn't even exist, in the case of many Holocaust survivors. So to return to the ancestral graves of the first Jews at the Machpelah was some kind of compensation for everything which had been denied for generations. And then on the third day, crackling over the army radio, The voice of Mota Gur, Har Habayit Biyadin. The words still give me chills. The Temple Mount is in our hands. For the first time in 2,000 years, not only had we established sovereignty in the state, but we had come back to that spot so precious, so holy, the place of our primary encounter with God. It's perhaps hard to remember just how emotional those times were, how we came from the depths of despair and depression to the heights of thinking that anything and everything was now possible, that we had been reconstituted from the ashes. For diaspora Jews, and here in America particularly, it gave us a strength of identity that had been unknown previously. We felt that we could hold our head high as Jews, and we began to think of Israel in a way that we had not thought of Israel before. It's hard to remember because we now think of Israel with such fondness for the most part. But until 1967, American Jews hadn't necessarily seen Israel in that light. The historian Gerald Auerbach observed, even the idea of a Jewish state, to say nothing of the reality of Israel, seldom inspired feelings of passionate attachment in the majority of American Jews. And in 1950, when David Ben-Gurion made the assertion that Israel was now the de facto center of the Jewish world population, it provoked an irate Jacob Blaustein, who was president of the American Jewish Committee at the time, and perhaps the most important lay leader within the American Jewish scene, to counter Ben-Gurion, saying, "There can be and will be no single spokesman for world Jewry, no matter who that spokesman might try to be." Israel was not the center for American Jewry until 1967 made it the center of Jewish life. We came to see Israel as the focal point of our strength. In 1 week, the week of the war, American Jews contributed $20 million to Israel. Big deal, you might say. In today's terms, it's $150 million. $150 million was raised for Israel in 1 week. We were passionate about the protection of the state and about seeing it at the center of the Jewish people. For many, Israel became their Judaism. It's a double-edged sword, of course. But for many people, Israel was what their Jewishness came to constitute. Don't tell me about giving money locally anymore. I only want to give money to Israel. Make sure that Israel is supported first and foremost. If God, mitzvot, Torah, was too esoteric a reach, Israel was the tangible embodiment of the Jewish people's aspirations in the contemporary age. And what did this strength that the Six-Day War gave us,
What did it enable us to do?
Extraordinary things. We realized something that the generation of the Shoah never could, that we could hold our heads high in public as Jews and go to the streets as Jews and demand our rights with power, because Israel gave us power. The Soviet Jewry movement would never have happened without the impetus of the Six-Day War. The idea that there is an AIPAC that we lobby and rally, or a J Street, for Jewish causes, for Israel, that we would have the chutzpah to make demands or requests of our political leaders, all of that strength emerges from the Six-Day War. In fact, one could even say that Holocaust memory, suppressed until that time, becomes something that we begin to talk about only when we are strong enough in our own identity to be able to talk about. One last observation. Shimon talked about the quasi-biblical nature of what happened in those 6 days. And when we look back, and when we reflect upon Jewish history, many ask themselves, appropriately, did we live through a miracle? Can we attach the term Ness, a miracle, to what we experienced? If it's not able to be explained simply in the realm of military history, then what ought we to say? How should we think about the Six-Day War from a theological perspective? Purim. At Purim, we turned around the decree that would have destroyed all the Jews of Shushan and made it from a day of despair to a day of rejoicing. What was to have been our death became our salvation. Where's the big miracle? There's no oil lasting for 8 days in the Purim events. There's just Esther at the right time, at the right place. And yet, for that we say, it was a miracle. The events of Purim were miraculous. Perhaps to the Six-Day War. You'll recall that Israel warned the Jordanians, don't get involved. Don't take part in this war. And we won't have anything to do with the areas over which you have control. The West Bank and Jerusalem. The Jordanians came in nevertheless. And Michael Oren, the previous Israeli ambassador to the United States, in his book about the Six-Day War, recounts the following extraordinary additional layer. Writes Oren, there was one moment when I was doing research when literally my jaw fell open. I discovered a document written on June 7th, 1967, the third day of the war, at 9 o'clock in the morning. At that moment, the Israeli paratroopers had completed the encirclement of the city of Jerusalem, and they were simply waiting for orders to go in. They were on the Mount of Olives. And at that moment, Prime Minister Eshkol wrote a letter to King Hussein of Jordan. "Your Majesty, if you agree here and now to a ceasefire, and if you agree to enter into peace talks with the State of Israel, the paratroopers will not enter the old city." Writes Oren, "Here is the leader of the first Jewish state in 2,000 years who is prepared and poised to reunite the Jewish people with their holiest sites imaginable, and he's willing to give up that historic opportunity to make peace with just one Arab country. Imagine the depth of our commitment to peace." But the Jordanians, of course, refused the offer. And for the first time in 2,000 years, Har Habayit Biyadin. 50 years later, it's hard not to think that if you believe in miracles, if you see the Tanakh as full of the extraordinary saga of a people that has known the lowest depths and the greatest heights, then we too have lived through something similar. So to Zechariah, I say, always, always by spirit, and sometimes when necessary, by might and power as well.